Iraq anyway. Why are we coming to write now? We're coming to write because it's imperative that you be able to visualize for yourself now that what we are saying is not just about poetry, it's not just about language, it's about any art. And the most socially amplitude of all arts is architecture. Architecture really does it. It's, to misquote the Coca-Cola classic commercial, it's as real as it gets. Frank Lloyd Wright had a teacher in architecture, Louis Sullivan, whose dictum was, he used to, Wright said he always used to come by and look at his drawings and cuff him on the shoulder and say, Wright, put yourself into it. Behind every building you see is a man that you don't see, the architect. But the architect has got to be there in the form of his building. Put yourself into it, boy. Well, Adler and Sullivan as an architectural firm in Chicago in the 1890s was big stuff. They were building the first skyscrapers. Really big, big things at that time. But they had a lot of wealthy clients, the owners of these companies, who wanted houses built, but they didn't want to bother with houses. So they gave the young Frank Lloyd Wright the houses to build. And Wright, in building the houses, was literally given carte blanche to develop Sullivan's idea that behind the building you see is a man you don't see. Only Wright, as a great artist, decided that he's not going to put himself into this house, he's going to put the person for whom he's building it. This house is going to be an organic continuity with the owner of the house. He built houses for the owners. Like he built Hollyhock House up here on Olive Hill for Eileen Barnsdall. And if you inform yourself about the personality of Eileen Barnsdall, that house is her. Wright captured her. That house is a portrait in architecture of Eileen Barnsdall. Not just of her facial features, but of her whole personality. And when you can see that, you can understand what a great artist Frank Lloyd Wright was. Architecture aside, an incredible artist. He had the ability to build from himself already when he was a young man. His mother was a what we would call today, I guess, a practical mystic, a visionary. When she had Frank Lloyd Wright in a pregnancy, she dreamed that he was going to be the world's greatest architect of all time. So she went out and she bought prints of Timothy Cole engravings of English cathedrals and details and hung the room that he was going to be in as a little baby with all these prints and got all of these toys. They were called Friebel's gifts. Friebel was a German educator in the 19th century. And they were basic geometric shapes and primary colors, which if a little baby plays with these, it evokes the deep mnemonic memory of the self, because these are primordialities. Squares and circles and triangles and reds and yellows and blues are the primordial language of feeling. In this world, they're always there. You can always count on them. So Wright was born into this and trained from birth, literally, to be an architect. And what's startled Wright is that other people had to think things through. Whereas Wright, when he saw a building, he saw it in its structure. He had the ability to see the structure of a building in one intuitive flash. But not just an intuition as an ambiguous realization, but he could see the building in terms of its structure so that he could literally sit down and he could draw the plan of the building from his mind straight out. But what was interesting to him was not the plan of the building in its detail, but its wholeness. He said continuously, a building should be not many things, but one thing. It should be itself. And what is itself? Itself is the person, in this case, the home of who is going to live there. So these are some quotations from The Natural House, written by Frank Lloyd Wright towards the end of his life. He was about 85 years old when he wrote this, 1954. He called Louis Sullivan Liebermeister, beloved master. Although the wraparound window, originally a minor outward expression of the interior folded plane in my own buildings and various other minor features of the work of this period, intended to simplify and eliminate parts, are now scattered around the world and have become the rather senseless features of various attempts at formula, such as the sporadic international and other attempts characterized by plain surfaces cut into patterns by simple large openings. In other words, he's saying everything has been imitated and everything has been lost in the imitation. The international style of cutting up space and form in simple geometric patterns in an external imitative process is producing a false wisdom. Nevertheless, the ideas behind these earlier appearances, the fundamental ideas that made them genuine expressions of architecture, have been altogether missed. The nature of materials is ignored in these imitations to get block mass outlines. The reverse of the period wherein mass material outlines try to ignore the materials, but it is the same mistake. In other words, he's saying the modern international style has a complementary fault which was in the gingerbread Victorian architecture that came before it. These are the new Victorians. They make the same goddamn error, excuse me, but they think that they're getting away from it because they have this false apposition of the appearance to ignorance. Whereas in the ancient Hermetic tradition, it's not the polarity and the tension between appearance and ignorance. Wisdom doesn't appear in that equation or that tension at all. It's nowhere there. True wisdom is nowhere there. If one is thinking in those terms with that kind of a mind, with that kind of a model, you're lost. That's it. It's best to go back to square one and start over again because it's not there at all. There's no resolution of truth. There's no realization of person in the polarity between ignorance and appearance. It's not there at all. That's the worldly illusion. That's Maya. That is Maya. There's no legitimacy possible there, no matter how brilliant you are, no matter how forceful you are. No matter how rich you are, there's nothing there. It's a sieve full of sand. So Wright is saying here, the fundamental ideas that made them genuine expressions of architecture have been altogether missed. The nature of materials is ignored in these imitations to get block mass outlines, the reverse of the period wherein mass material outlines tried to ignore the materials. It's the same mistake. The word plastic was a word Louis Sullivan himself was fond of using in reference to his scheme of ornamentation as distinguished from all other or any applied ornament. But now, and not merely as form following function, came a larger application of the element called plasticity. Form follows function is mere dogma until you realize the higher truth that form and function are one. To put it in our context, how you got to be who you are is the same of who you are. It's not like you can go to places and develop the physical aspect, develop the mental aspect, develop the emotional. you're going to be a composite person. Isn't that form follows function? Form is function. The function operating is the form. That is not the appearance of it, but that's its reality. Notice the structural onus here. So right continues. Why any principle working in part if not working in the whole? I promoted plasticity, as conceived by Liebermeister, to continuity. He took the idea of plasticity from the mind and experience, the personality of Louis Sullivan, and he amplified it and developed it. Sullivan was able to have very good ideas, but he could never translate them into life. Sullivan is a very tragic figure. He died broke and penniless and an alcoholic in a hotel room. But Wright was able to give birth to this idea from Louis Sullivan in his artistic practice, and Wright himself became the architect which the promise of Louis Sullivan held. It's a great story. I promoted plasticity as conceived by Liebermeister to continuity, his beloved master, in the concept of the building as a whole. If the dictum form follows function had any bearing at all on building, it could take form in architecture only by means of plasticity when seen at work as complete continuity. In other words, Louis Sullivan saw plasticity as a new way of handling ornament and then the structure of a building, but he saw it as the application of an idea onto the material, whereas Wright internalized the idea and symbolically realized that this was a vision of a new structure from the inside out. Sullivan had the idea and applied it to the outside. Wright took the idea and gave birth to a vision that came from the inside and expressed out, so that what became real for Wright was the space of a building and not its walls, as it were, not the walls. What is in the space of a building, a work of architecture? The life of the people who occupy that building, their life movement, as it were, is what is in that space. So you can see that right here, right away, is trying to express late in his life the genesis of his whole artistic realization at the very beginning of his life, that he was no longer dealing with ignorance and appearance, but had committed himself to deal only with wisdom, only with the deepest, deep self interior legitimacy. In fact, he did it from day one, from the very first house that he ever built, the Winslow House. You can see Wright. It isn't, as Wright says, it isn't my style. That's there, but it's the legitimacy of the building as the space of the person. So he writes, why not throw away entirely all implications of post and beam construction? Now, normally an architect who writes in this way is crazy. If you throw away the construction, the post and beam construction, you don't have anything to work with. Can you see that that's like ignorance coming in? But Wright is saying that's exactly right. I don't want to work with that ignorance that sees that if you take the post and beam away that you have nothing. There isn't nothing there. There's space there, and I want to work with space. Can you see the radical, monumental genius of Wright? I don't know what you've heard or read, but you have to understand that it's a great man, a fantastic insight into the nature of reality. Have no posts, no columns, No pilasters, no cornices, no moldings, no ornament, no divisions of any sort, nor allow any fixtures whatever to enter as something added to the structure. Any building should be complete, including all within itself, instead of many things, one thing. So he's making only one thing. In this case, the house. He's not making rooms. He's not making walls. He's making the house. And this became the natural house. Later on in life, Wright became concerned with the way people characteristically misunderstood what he said. He noticed the tendency, and all visionaries see this, that the naive mind always takes an oblique angle, never hears what you're saying, always hears some version of what you're saying. And so he changed from calling it the natural house to calling it the Usonian house. He used that term towards the end of his life. I think he generated the term at a lecture series at the University of Chicago, the Usonian house. So here is what he says about the house as one thing. The folded plane enters here with the merging lines. What is a folded plane? It's a plane. Here's a folded plane. And you can carry it around. You can do all sorts of things with it. The folded plane. Notice that the continuity here, when the popular imagination began to see and perceive what Wright was doing, they coined a term which now is in the dictionary, streamline. Streamline. It's the line that water would flow in, and that's the form of the structure. And Wright is the one who first made this. Notice that it comes just a little bit ahead of and leads the literary genre of stream of consciousness writing. Stream of consciousness writing comes into play in a sympathy, a resonant symbolic sympathy with Frank Lloyd Wright's streamlined continuity in architecture. Is this true? Yes, it's absolutely true. When a sage is working with the deep self, it can't help but have a resonance in the universe. Every element in the physical universe that's ordered at all tunes itself to that vibration. Has to. It's like a friend of mine one time did a painting. I was on Hollywood Boulevard in my bookstore and having a hell of a time. And a friend of mine painted the high C of Gabriel. You know, Gabriel on his horn hitting the high C. It was a red painting with a vibrant red deeper red outline of a yellow note placed way up in this red. So red against red in this yellow note, the high C. And the phrase, of course, in black charismatic religious experience is when Gabriel hits the high C, that'll be judgment day. Because when that angel plays that note on that horn, everything is going to jump to it, you see, because that's the high C. I didn't know if you understood street wisdom or not. So I used to look at the high C and feel good about my problems, which were numerous. So Wright is saying here, the folded plane enters here with merging lines, walls and ceilings made one. Let walls, ceilings, floors now become not only party to each other, but part of each other, reacting upon and within one another. Continuity in all, eliminating any merely constructed features as such, or any fixture or appliance whatsoever as such. When Louis Sullivan had eliminated background in his system of ornament in favor of an integral sense of the whole, He had implied this larger sense of the thing. I now began to achieve it. He implied it in his idea. I began to achieve it in my art. Notice the relationship of an idea to art. I know it's passé in a deconstructivist artistic environment to talk about ideas and arts. It's real. It actually works. So the last paragraph, then we'll take a break. Conceive that here came a new sense of building on American soil that could grow building forms, not only true to function, but expressive far beyond mere function into the realm of the human spirit. Our new country might now have a true architecture hitherto unknown. It sounds kind of arrogant to us, but remember, Wright is thinking of this in 1893, and the Lewis and Clark expedition was what, just 80 years before. It was new. Yes, architectural forms by this interior means might now grow up to express a deeper sense of human life values than any existing before. Why? Why would it be a deeper sense? Because one is now able to build with materials that were never available to man before, like steel and glass and concrete. Man had always been limited by his materials before. Fantastic as a Gothic cathedral is, it stretches to the breaking point the material. Man is still within the prison of the material. He can only imply the idea of transcendence, the idea of freedom. And Wright says now with steel and glass and concrete and who knows what else is coming scientifically, man no longer is limited by material means. What does that mean to the expression of spiritual values? It means that a new vision is necessary. But it means also that the new materials are so powerful, like the new written language 3,700 years ago, that if we don't have new people to use the new materials, the materials are going to produce the curse for sure, instead of the blessing that the vision can see. If we don't do it, it won't get done. If we, right here, if we don't get it and able to work with it, it's not going to happen. And the obverse is going to happen, like King Thomas said, the new materials of science are going to produce forgetfulness and a kind of appearance of wisdom only. And you can see that already the world is in a situation where even to the man on the street it's obvious that somehow nothing's working right. Nothing anywhere is working right. There isn't any place that's working right. There's no country. There's no social institution, there's no human philosophy, there's no political doctrine that's working right. Why? Because all of them have to be refashioned. I know it's sweeping, but you can put 16 L's along with that. All of them have to be reworked. Why? Because there are new conditions which outstrip the old capacities. The old way of being human is never going to be able to handle the new situation. It doesn't do you one damn bit of good to be a Frenchman on a planet circling around the star Alpha Centauri. You can still be a Frenchman, but you got to work that in as a personality trait with a new sense of self. Now, the ancient tradition was that everything up to the moon is limited by this world. And you cannot go beyond the moon, beyond the lunar Everything sublunary is of this world. It's been 20 years, coming up in a month or so, since man first went to the moon and hasn't gone an inch beyond. Why is that? That's because no one is going to go even one inch beyond until there is a new man, as it were, a new person. And meanwhile, without that flower of amplification, the new technologies and new capacities are beginning to suffocate the old personality. By the time this generation is ready to pass on, if we haven't passed that threshold, it's going to be tyrannical indeed. It's simply a fact that the new capacities, the new technologies, are simply going to outdistance our ability to even keep up. They have an inherent new spin, as it were, and the old personality is static compared to the new spin. And it's like a leaf in a storm. But it doesn't have to be a leaf in a storm. A bird in the storm can fly it. A leaf is just going to be spun. So what we're after here is to try to develop ourselves to stop being dead leaves and to be our own spiritual selves. What should we do then? Help others, because there's plenty. There's enough work to go around. Let's take a break. Do you want a cushion, Gustavo?
Okay.
When I came down from Canada in 1975, my head was just filled with visions, and I didn't understand why I'm doing this. I resigned from a tenured faculty position. I had, you know, everything made, and I'd given up everything just on because the reoccurring vision to, you know, to go to Los Angeles and work, and I didn't know what to work at or where. And I got into town, and I bought this chair from an antique store in Chinatown, Fong. And I had it for years, and I never sat in it. It had belonged to an old doctor, and I thought occasionally, you know, it's pretty kooky. You paid all that money, you don't even sit in it. And the first time I tried to sit in it, it came loose, so that it was constantly, every time I sat in it, collapsing. I could not sit in the chair without it collapsing. And so when that happens enough, you know, then you think to yourself, well, they're telling me something. So then I never sat in it for a long time. And I had a bookstore in Hollywood for about 7 years, and I never sat in it. And then when I started lecturing at the PRS, three or four years, I never sat in it. And finally, Walter fixed the chair one day, and Chris and a couple of other students got this cushion made for me. And ever since then, I've been able to sit in this chair, and I feel like it's my chair. Isn't that amazing? But the odd thing is, I don't know what I did, because there's no event. I thought about it a lot, I must tell you. There's no event. It's just that in the matter of life, it just happened that I've finally fit. It just happened. And one day, you look back and you find yourself that you're actually doing it. It's amazing, isn't it? So I don't know why, but I thought you'd like to know. I have so many peculiarities. I'm glad that you're able to set them aside occasionally. I'm going to give you a little more of Wright, and then we're going to go to some works of art. And let me say this about the artworks. You can understand more poignantly than before. All of these art assignments or projects are not meant as busy work, but they're meant to be evocative, to be like a slice of orange to your sense of taste. And not just the word orange, slice of orange, but an actual slice of orange. So that you get the taste of true creativity. And that true creativity is not just an imaginative procedure, as is usually talked about, but is really involves a kind of wholeness in remembering yourself, so that when you do something, the creativity is that you yourself are doing it. You are doing it. So like you're writing the haikus, you're working on the sculptures, reworking each other's sculptures is all a part towards that. And now there are two projects that are coming up that need to be done almost simultaneously, although in terms of our time, we're going to differentiate them because I'm trying to show you how to learn. I'm not teaching you a subject, but I'm trying to show you how to learn so that you can do this for yourself and for others. I don't know where you're going to go. Wherever you go and whatever you do, you can carry this with you because it'll be a way in which you really are. So the mask assignment and the painting assignment are differentiated for educational purposes, but really they occur together. This is the performance. The sculpture and the haiku assignments were like rehearsal. And now the rehearsals are over, and now it's opening night. It's time to perform. And so your making of the painting, making a painting at this particular juncture is going to be really expressive of yourself. It's not a question of knowing how to paint. You don't have to be a Vermeer. It's a question of you doing this now. And however it turns out, that will be it. Whatever comes out, that will be it. That's exactly what you want to have right now. The mask as a mask of a role is a way of cinching that consciousness for yourself, that though you do in fact play roles, the playing of the roles is not the illegitimate part of life. The fact that you have to play roles or that you do play roles does not make you illegitimate in terms of your reality. Was Lionel Barrymore any less of Lionel Barrymore for the fact that he could do roles really well? Not at all. Not at all. So the important thing here is to see the lesson of good acting. You put yourself wholly in that role, and when the scene for that role is over, you take yourself out of that role. And when you get really good at that, you can be in character in your mind or in your feelings. And you can get so good at it, you can play with it. So that the ego, which is normally shunned as a false self, oh, it's egotistical. Ego, ego, ego. Let's get rid of the ego. Don't be in such a rush to get rid of things. It may come in handy. It's a role which in its scenario, the world, is really important. It's just that don't let it dominate you. It is a role which you can play, but you're not limited by that. And the ego, when you put your whole self into it, becomes a very nice role, a gorgeous role, a fat role. Whatever ego has come out of your life, even though there are aspects that you may not like, that ego has a real important function. It was in a pragmatic, realistic, practical way arrived at through a long conscious and unconscious experience in this world. Your ego really has a place in this kind of a world. Not a perfect world at all. It's a place where egos are very effective. But the ego becomes purified, not by getting rid of it, but by putting your whole personality, your whole self, into that role so that it's played with fullness and wholesomeness instead of as a bit part. Instead of being a hack, you're an artist. Now, there's a real fundamental difference in that. But it takes practice to learn to do that. And you can't even do it unless you can imagine to yourself, first of all, that such a thing is possible. I told recently, I don't know if it was Tuesday or Thursday night, that little Chuang Tzu story. No, I guess I was telling it over pizza to somebody. About the little birds hopping around in the bush and talking to each other and saying, you know, they say that there's this huge bird that is so large that when it flaps its wings once, it goes 100,000 miles. Well, but that can't be. I mean, all of us are pretty good, and we have trouble getting from bush to bush. And 20 feet is a long flight. No, there couldn't be such a bird. But there is. You need to understand that there are human beings larger than you can imagine. And they are real and not just fictive. And that one of those human beings is you. And it's like the saying goes, all you need is one. One real self is all you ever need. Now notice the difference here. Don't look for the right role. Don't look for the most powerful, protective, domineering ego. That's not where the power comes from. The power comes from reality, from legitimacy of being able to give the gift of spirit to that ego. Even a little shoemaker stuck away in some village, if he's really there, the whole world knows about that. That shoemaker. Such a shoemaker was Jacob Behme, the greatest mystic of the 17th century. Just a shoemaker. So you can get the feel from this. I want to give you one more quotation from Wright, and then we'll go to the paintings, see what paintings we have. This is Wright in The Natural House in the chapter In the Nature of Materials of Philosophy. And I think I'll give you just a couple of pages of this, if I can. Right at 85 was really something. He had an interview one time with Hugh Downs, when Hugh Downs was real young, just starting off in broadcasting. And Downs asked him, said, "Well, Mr. Wright, at the end of a long life, and you're looking back, and you see all of these imitators that you've had, and almost nobody really as a successor, are you not saddened by this and disillusioned with mankind?" And Wright looked up and crossed his legs, and he looked at Downs with a kind of a glint in his eye, and in a level way he said, "No." He said, "I think it's always been this way. I think that human beings have always learned by way of abuse that in misplaying with the materials, we still learn about the materials. So we learn by way of abuse." And that's a wonderful, you have to be 90 years old to be able to say that, but you can be any age to be able to hear that. So don't worry about your mistakes. They're valuable. They're the other side of the orange. Don't throw the rind away. It's the purifier. Here's Wright. I'll just read this to you, and then we'll go to a painting. "Our vast resources are yet new, new only because architecture as rebirth, a perennial renaissance, has, after five centuries of decline, culminated in the imitation of imitations, seen in our Mrs. Plasterbilt or Mrs. Gablemore and Miss Flattop American architecture. In general, and especially officially, our architecture is at long last completely significant of insignificance only. We do not longer have architecture, at least no buildings with integrity. We have only economic crimes in its name. No, our greatest buildings are not qualified as great art, my mere Mrs. Davies, although you do admire Washington. If you will yet be patient for a little while, a scientist, Einstein, asked for 3 days to explain the far less pressing and practical matter of relativity, we will take each of the five new resources in order as with the five fingers of the hand. Those who have been, who a couple of years ago followed my Taoist series, sees how subtle Frank Lloyd Wright is, how masterful. Why? Because the hand, east and west, is the esoteric symbol of the process of completeness. Whether it's the Upanishads or Taoism or the Hermetic tradition, the hand held up like that is the sign, like the Hermetic star, of completeness. The completeness of the process, not the object. And the hand is the sign of fearlessness in the sense that this process always comes round to its integrity. Not to the same place, but to its integrity, which are frequently different. So he's going to talk about five kinds of material as the hand. We're not going to take all five, but just begin with it so you can see. But I want you to understand that Wright is being very Taoist here, extremely Taoist. Can we use that term, extremely Taoist? It's a rhetorical faux pas, but you know what I mean. All are new integrities to be used, if we will, to make living easier and better today. The first great integrity is a deeper, more intimate sense of reality in building than was ever pagan, that is to say, than was ever classic. More human than was any building ever realized in the Christian Middle Ages. This is true, although the thought that may ennoble it now has been living in civilization more than 20 centuries back. Later it was innate in the simplicities of Jesus as it was organic 500 years earlier in the natural philosophy of Tao, the way of the Chinese philosopher Lao Tzu. But not only is the new architecture sound philosophy, it is poetry. Said one Giao Qi, Chinese sage, poetry is the sound of the heart. Well, like poetry, this sense of architecture is the sound of the within. We might call that within the heart. Architecture now becomes integral, the expression of a new old reality, the livable interior space of the room itself. The livable interior space of the room itself. Notice he's not talking about the space of the room. He's talking about a quality of life which complementary is in that space, which may be a room or not. The within. Architecture is the sound of the within.